on 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Jess Rowe lives in New York City, but his debut novel is set in Baltimore, where he attended high school. And the settings around town in which this provocative story takes place will no doubt be familiar. So will some of the people, including a few employees of a local public radio station. But I think perhaps what won't be familiar is the imaginative premise of this very insightful novel. One of the protagonists, Martin Lipkin, is white and Jewish. Before the novel begins, he has self-diagnosed himself with what he calls racial identity dysphoria syndrome, and he has undergone racial reassignment surgery to become African American. As his story is revealed, the author Jess Rowe tackles the issues of racial identity, white privilege, and the notion of starting your life over again as a completely new person. Mr. Rowe will be talking about his book tomorrow night at Red Emma's Bookstore, and this morning he joins me on the line from New York. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So to give folks a little idea of the setup of the book, introduce us to Martin Wilkinson and Kelly Thorndike, your two protagonists.
These are two men who grew up in Baltimore together in the early 1990s. They were teenagers in high school in the early 1990s, and they were in a band together. They went to the same private high school, slightly outside the city, but they had a very active life in the city in the underground music scene. And after high school, very tragic thing happened to them. They were in a band that was three people, and the third member of the band, whose name was Alan, their mutual best friend, died of a drug overdose. And after that, their lives, Martin's life and Kelly's life, took very different paths. Kelly went on to Amherst and then moved to China and then went to Harvard and got a PhD in Chinese literature and became a public radio employee when academia didn't pan out. And he's lived away from Baltimore for many, many years. He comes back to Baltimore after another tragedy in his life. His wife, who's Chinese, and young daughter are killed in a car accident in Cambridge, where they're living. And he, out of desperation, comes back to Baltimore for a public radio job because he really has nowhere else to go, and he's sort of looking to regenerate himself. He's at Mondawmin Mall in sort of a... what to him is sort of a random location, not someplace that he goes very often. And a black man approaches him across the parking lot. And it turns out that black man is Martin, who he hasn't seen in 20 years and who, when he last saw him, was a 20-year-old or 19-year-old white Jewish kid named Martin Lipkin, and now is a adult African-American man, a successful entrepreneur who's married to a black woman, has black children, lives a very established life in the community. And what nobody knows about Martin Wilkinson is that he was a white teenager who underwent this crisis and decided that he had this racial identity dysphoria syndrome, that he's transracial, and went to Thailand and had racial reassignment surgery, found a kind of renegade surgeon who did the surgery on him to transform him into, what from the outside is the appearance of an ordinary black person, a person you would see anywhere on the street.
This syndrome, for example, racial identity dysphoria syndrome, and the notion of a racial reassignment surgery, surgically changing someone's race, is that real or is that a product of your imagination?
It's actually a little bit of both. When I started thinking about this book, I was reading another book about the history of plastic surgery and the invention of rhinoplasty of the nose job, which was invented by a German surgeons, some of whom were Jewish, in the 19th century. And when I was just sort of leafing through that book, it came to me that in our culture, in our time, one very well could come up with a notion of racial dysphoria or racial reassignment surgery. And it, to me, at that moment, it seemed like this isn't really that surprising. It's not something that exists in the world, but it could exist. And that's sort of where I began thinking through the novel, from the premise of such a thing could exist and the conditions in some ways are right for it, but it doesn't exist yet. So I felt like I'd sort of put my finger on something that I felt like was sort of just about to happen.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Jess Rowe. His new novel is called Your Face in Mine. He'll be talking about it at Red Emma's bookstore tomorrow night. There are some analogies that you draw in the novel and that come immediately to mind with people who have transgender issues, people who get operations to change their gender. Martin says at one point that he's a black man in a white man's body. What leads him to that conclusion? And is that journey similar to those who get gender altering surgery as well?
That's a difficult question to answer. I think that transgender people come from all different kinds of backgrounds and experiences. For Martin, what happens is that he grows up in a kind of eccentric family situation. His father is a gay man. His mother he was born on a commune down near Edgewater in rural Maryland in the 1970s. And his mother left very soon after his birth. So he was raised by his father, who's a gay man, and a very, almost a sort of a claustrophobic person who lives near Greenmount Avenue in that section of the city, in a mostly African American section of the city, and Martin begins his life going to a fictional elementary school in that neighborhood where he's the only white child. So he has an experience from early in life of identifying very closely with black people and really finding that a lot of the parental figures in his life and the closest friends and the people he's most intimate with are black people. And then as he moves along through his life, he winds up in what's called the Willow School in the novel, which is the private school outside the city, which is overwhelmingly white and upper middle class and academic. And it's that the dysphoria for him, as he describes it himself, the dysphoria begins there. He has this feeling of origins in the black community, and even a sense of childhood selfhood in that community. And then he experiences this huge disjunct with the person he's brought up to be when he enters, essentially when he enters the white world. And then in his early 20s, he has some depression. He doesn't know what to do with his life. He's involved in kind of low-level and then higher-level crime. He has a real sense of crisis of identity. And it comes to him sort of as a shock that this could be the solution to his problems.
Because this whole question of identity and what comprises identity is something that is constantly on the reader's mind during this novel. I mean, what do you think the ingredients of identity are if they're not race, if they're not ethnicity, if they're not gender for that matter? How do people establish what their identity is?
Well, I mean, I think I would never say it's not those things. I have to say I think those elements, gender and sexuality and race, or perceived race or ethnicity, cultural origins, socioeconomic origins, those are all huge components of our identity. What I think in the sort of thinking that went into this novel, and I think the thinking that came out of the novel for me, is that these things are much more fluid than we ordinarily assume them to be, and that there's more sort of choice, there's more room in our lives for manipulation of our own identities than we normally think there is. And for me, some of that experience comes from having lived outside the United States and experiencing the way that people in other parts of the world, especially Asia, have a different sense of identity, and also a different sense of the fluidity of identity.
If we take just the single issue of treatment of black people by police departments across the country, we have LeVar Ferguson in South Carolina, we've got Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, we've got a gentleman named Colin Truss here in Baltimore. The city of Baltimore has paid nearly $6 million, according to a Sun investigative report just a few days ago, since 2011 to settle police brutality cases. Are you taking up the matter of whether it's easier to be white than it is to be a person of color? And if so, it seems like it's not much of a leap to go from easier to better. And is that troublesome?
Well, it is troublesome, and I would say absolutely it is easier to be a person. It is easier to be a white person in the United States than a person of color, in so many ways. And part of what I wanted to do in this novel was have, you know, often passing narratives in American culture have to do with a person of color trying to become white. And what I wanted to do with this book was reverse the equation, because I really wanted to draw attention to the sort of the desires that draw white people away from whiteness out of a sense of guilt, out of a sense of not knowing what whiteness is, out of a sense of discomfort with privilege and power. But all that said, there can never be any mistaking the fact that, you know, whiteness is a place, is a position of privilege and power. And it's very easy for white people to forget that. And I, you know, I would say, you know, I'm not a police officer and I'm not involved in policing, but I think there's a certain element in modern policing, part of what's being called the sort of militarization of policing, that has to do with setting the police apart from the community that they belong to. And this, I think, is the most radical kind of mistake, because I think the most basic thing that we all have to embrace, that we all have to come to accept in one way or another, is that we are part of the same human family, and that everybody has a mother, everybody has a father, and that everybody deserves to be treated with dignity. And if you don't start policing with that philosophy in mind, then policing just reinforces the power structure that we already experience. You know, policing should be used to protect people from the power structure, not reinforce it. But we've fallen into a pattern where you know, policing reproduces the power structure.
Well, that's one of the many provocative issues that this book raises. Jess Roe, his debut novel is called Your Face and Mine. He'll be reading from the book and discussing it tomorrow night at Red Emma's Bookstore Coffee House in the Station North Arts and Entertainment District. That event begins at 7:30. We've got all the details at a link on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Well, Jess Roe, thanks so much for your time. This is a terrific book. I recommend it highly, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay produce the program. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. Payam Agagasam and Elizabeth Sherwood help out with production. Let us know what you think about the interviews you've heard on our show, or give us a suggestion about an interview you'd like to hear. Send us a tweet, find us on Facebook, or come to wypr.org/Maryland Morning. And of course, you can listen to a live stream of Maryland Morning on any device. Come to wypr.org/listen. Coming up Friday, Sheila has the story of a murder in Baltimore County in 1999 that's the subject of a year-long podcast produced by This American Life. And I'll be joined by our movie mavens, Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday, for tips on the flicks to catch this weekend. We'll see you Friday. For Sheila, Nathan, and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.